This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there, we really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. Welcome to the Nolan Show this Tuesday morning. We led with the so-called show of strength for the UVF yesterday, and we're leading with it today again, because you shrug your shoulders at this stuff. You think, well, that's what happens in Northern Ireland, and you don't focus on what is actually staring you in the face. These people who come out and still collect protection money and still maim and still intimidate people in their own community. And you think to yourself, hold on a minute, 2024, and as we discussed yesterday, they're still getting transitioning. They're still doing that after all of these years. So day two of our scrutiny on what has happened at the weekend in Northern Ireland. The pace, and I say they are reviewing CCTV of this so-called show of strength. 1,500 people, white shirts, black ties, black trousers, lined the Newton Arch Road for a memorial event. But it was more than that. It was a show of strength. Church leader Reverend Mervyn Gibson spoke to BBC News NI's Lindsay Telford. He was at the parade.
But my concern and the concern of others was that whatever was done didn't raise any tensions, indeed any violence. I think that happened on Saturday night. There were certainly no tensions raised. There were certainly no violence after it. And I don't see any tensions emanating from the parade. I had been talking to all involved in what has been described as a dispute. And nobody wanted any bother whatsoever, and people, I think, went out of their way to ensure there wasn't any. I don't see anybody's looking for trouble over this. If there's internal issues within an organisation, let them deal with it, but let them do so peacefully, and I believe that's what they're doing.
Those internal issues within the organisation are the kind of gangsters, the wasters who intimidate and do all that they do, fighting with each other over a power grab, fighting and disputing and squaring up to each other for power of their territory. The Justice Minister, Naomi Long, said communities are weary of these paramilitaries.
I think it is incredibly disturbing that at this juncture in Northern Ireland we continue to see such shows of strength. I think the people of Northern Ireland generally and of East Belfast in particular are weary of these paramilitary organisations.
Belfast Telegraph rolling the headline this morning. Pace and I spoke to church chiefs before disturbing UVF display. Alison Morris is their crime correspondent. Morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Well, they're not physically fighting each other, but this show of strength, they're marking territory. Have we to be grateful for that somehow in Northern Ireland and just ignore them taking to our streets?
Well, look, I suppose there's a number of things. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, and had I been reporting on this kind of internal dispute in a paramilitary group like the UVF 10 or 15 years ago, you would certainly have been reporting on violence, if not worse, if not murder, because we've seen how those internal disputes among these type of groups have played out in the past, and they have resulted in violence. In this case, there is no violence and there's no talk of violence. And you heard Mervyn Gibson speak there. I spoke to him yesterday as well. And he says there's absolutely no appetite for that on either side. And I suppose in terms of the people who live, who are often caught up in the middle of these lawless feuds, well, that is a good thing and they will be grateful, because what we've seen in the past is that innocent people do get caught up in the middle of this violence. But it'll also be very strange that we're speaking about such an unusual event that wouldn't be tolerated, I don't think, in most other jurisdictions, as if this is quite normal and that we should all just accept the fact that, you know, 1,500 UVF men were bussed into East Belfast to sort of flex their muscles in a show of strength or, a power grab or whatever that was intended to be on Saturday.
And tell me about this feud that's going on between what sections of Belfast, and what's it about?
well, again, I'm not even sure feud is the right word, but basically what happened is last November, loyalists held Remembrance Day events, and there was statements read at several of those events saying that the leadership of the UVF was standing down a number of people from East Belfast. Didn't name anyone, it didn't name any names, but I believe there was about 8 people who were in the sort of line of fire from the leadership of the East Belfast UVF. They stood those people down, and then what they did was they put somebody else in that person's place and said, this is now the new leader of the East Belfast UVF. That didn't really go down well locally. I mean, I've spent the past sort of week trying to get my head around what was going on there, but what I've been told is that probably about 50 people said that they would go with this new leader and be loyal to him. About 100 to 150 older people said that, you know, we're finished anyway and we were looking for an excuse to walk away from this and have nothing more to do with it, and this is our excuse, we're gone. This is our opportunity to leave. And so they have left and went back to normal lives or whatever that is they've went back to. And the rest of the UVF sort of located around the previous leader, and they have remained loyal to them. And it's a strange situation because they would say that they still have a lot of respect for the person who is an elderly man who's the leader of the UVF, and that there's no problem with them, between them and what's going on there. But there is obviously some kind of issue with the Shankill-based leadership of the UVF and East Belfast. And instead of that unfolding with people being, you know, exiled from the community or put in their houses or shot or all the things that would have happened in the past, it seems to be a very strange power play that's playing out on the streets during these commemorations and events. And so what happened on Saturday was there was an annual memorial, which takes place every year, to a guy called Robert Seymour, who was a UVF man who was murdered by the IRA in 1988. And the previous leadership, the sort of old leadership, if you like it, of the East Belfast faction, held their own memorial in Roselawn Cemetery. And that was attended by quite a few people who would be older UVF ex-prisoners, who would be probably known names that would appear in the Sunday papers sort of quite regularly years ago. And then they had the main band parade, which had been applied for by the Parades Commission and had been given legal permission to take place by the Parades Commission, as it does every year. It's in a loyalist area, it's not at a flashpoint, there's no contention above that. But what wasn't as part of that application, or wasn't known, I suppose, to the Parades Commission, was that the UVF planned to do this show of strength. So they planned to bus men in from everywhere, and this was to stand behind the new leader of the UVF, who was at the very front of that procession, to say, you know, here is the new boss, and this is who we're backing. And that was the signal that they were sending out. And you heard Naomi Long mention that. She says that, you know, it wasn't a show of strength, it was a show of fragility, you know, bringing people onto the streets to try and intimidate people. And all of that is playing out. And the police, like myself, had probably heard the online speculation, seen some of the rumours and WhatsApp messages that were going around saying that this group was coming to East Belfast on Saturday, and that they were going to go to people's houses and march on their houses and force them from their home, and there was going to be all sorts of violence. And that all proved to be just speculation, and whether that was someone who thought it was a good idea to do that, or whether it was just coming from nonsense of people online. And we know that they spoke to church figures, several other people, including Mervyn Gibbs, in relation to that, who would be someone much more in tune, I suppose, with what's going on than most people. And he was told exactly what I and other journalists were told, is that, you know, there's no appetite for violence, but clearly there is a sort of power play going on.
And that power play, so what's it, what is it about in terms of, I'm slightly confused, there is no imminent potential for violence between the two, so why do they need to display this power play?
Well, this is where I'm confused as well, because what we were told last year, especially after that November statement, is that the UVF itself, the paramilitary group itself, was in very late game transition talks with the British and Irish governments, and that there was a lot of work had been done in the years previously. And we've also seen this indicated in the Independent Reporting Commission, which takes time to look at what's going on within these organisations, and that the leadership of the UVF was very was currently in the very last stages of that civilianisation, transition, whatever you want to call it, and that they were going to be basically disbanded and they would retain the name only to be used for commemorations and some sort of like old boys commemorative society. And that's what we were told was in the very advanced stages. Now, if you're in the advanced stages of transitioning or, you know, civilianization or whatever you want to call it, and I know that there's people listening to this probably think it's utterly ridiculous. Why are we talking about this? Why didn't the police just go in and deal with them? But that's the way we live, and that's the situation we're in now. If that is the case, what on earth were they doing forming a 1,500 men show of strength down the Newton Arts Road? To me, that does not appear the actions of an organisation preparing to leave the stage, transition, civilianisation. To me, that looks like an organisation that's saying, we're still an authority. And in fact, in so much authority, look how many people we can bring out onto the street at, you know, the click of our fingers and the drop of a hat. And that, to me, is, you know, and Naomi Long was right, that there's intimidation in that in the community. There was plenty of people who go along to watch those bands, some very young fellows, you know, guys and girls who you'll see if you're watching the videos, who go along to watch those bands. It's a Saturday afternoon if you're 14 or 15. You know, that's probably what you would be doing if you were living on the Newton Arch Road, and that's what they're saying. And to me, anyone who is dealing with that transition from the British Irish government and any other organisations, including some of those that are quite heavily funded, would need to be asking themselves who it is they're dealing with and what exactly is going on here. Are they being taken for agents and being told one thing while on the street something else is playing out?
And Alison, this show of strength, how was it received by whoever the other side is in this thing?
The bizarre thing is they seem to just basically ignore it. The person, and, you know, his name people can find if they want to read newspapers, but I'm not saying on your show, but the person he's widely believed to be the leader, the previous leader, whatever you want to call him, was in a local bar handing out football trophies to children, do you know what I mean? I mean, there was basically an ignoring of the entire thing as if it wasn't happening. And that was what went on. Why there was no, you know, standoff or people glaring at each other across the road or anything like that. It seemed to be that there was an acceptance that this was going to happen, and they'd made a decision to completely ignore it. But there was graffiti painted on a wall, which would indicate that at least some of those people within that East Belfast faction were not too happy at people from the Shankill coming into their area to have a show of strength. That was painted over quite quickly after this happened. But I mean, there's the fallout for this, from this, cannot be underestimated in terms of where we are now when we're looking at what is happening with loyalist paramilitaries. Do they ever have any intention of transition or civilianising? Is this now, we're now at the point where at some stage we have to accept that this is not going to happen and that this is now a law enforcement and policing matter and it's nothing to do with the politics of our past.
But,
I mean, this year, I am currently working on a series of stories to do with the 30th anniversary of the ceasefires. This is the 30th year since the IRA ceasefire and also since the combined Loyalist Military Command called their ceasefire. And did anyone think who was reporting on those ceasefires 30 years ago that they would still be reporting on the like of this 30 years later?
But you mentioned the PSNI. Their job, ultimately, is to try to do everything they can so that there is not mass violence on the streets. So in the real politic of Northern Ireland, does that mean that they will hold back, that they're not going to go in and make major arrests, that they're not going to arrest people even if the law asks them to, which would create tension in the area, and so let the hair sit. Sit back. Look at the greater good. Let these leaders prevail. Let these people be part of illegal organisations, but sit back as long as there's no mass violence. Is that potentially what the PSNI need to do?
Well, I mean, the first time I ever heard the phrase, you know, least worst option policing was during the flag protest when a senior officer I was interviewing said, when I asked why they weren't moving people off the roads, they said, well, it's the least worst option policing, which I thought was just such a strange phrase at the time, but basically means if we go in, you know, with our batons raised, start cracking heads and dragging people around, it'll result in mass violence that could go on for days. That was never going to happen on Saturday, because I am still struggling to work out what, in terms of legalities, what anyone could be charged with, because they applied for the parade and that was accepted, albeit they applied for a much larger parade actually that took place. They didn't wear what we've seen. I mean, I spoke to you at the time about the Roselawn situation where the UDA held a funeral in Roselawn Crematorium And in that, the pictures of that, you can see they have UDA jackets with UDA logos on them. You know, there's the varies of sunglasses, the full UDA uniform. That's illegal. That's, you know, paramilitary style dress, which is a breach of the law. In this case, they showed up in white shirts and black ties and black trousers. There's no logos anywhere near them. So I'm not sure. I would say the police are probably scratching their head as much as anyone else trying to work out what they can charge them with. What we have seen is the Paramilitary Crime Task Force move in on people and arrest them in connection with drugs, albeit they'll say, we believe this is a connection with such and such faction, but not actually charge the person with membership. I mean, in this case, we do have the ridiculous situation where one of the people who was, you know, seen wearing the black and white uniform is actually before the courts for other serious charges as well. So there's a sort of flouting of, you know, we can do whatever we want and it really doesn't matter. And people watching that, especially people who see how things play out in different sections of our society. So we do have a problem. As we know, we're dissident Republicans and violent dissident Republicans who are involved in serious criminality and are a threat to the state. And when they are on gun charges or any kind of other paramilitary charges, their bail conditions are much, much tighter. They're remanded often for long periods of time. So people will be saying, why is there a difference in treatment of these two groups?
Alison, thank you very much. Morning to you. John's our first call of the day. Morning, John. John's not there. Dr. Aaron Edwards, Honorary Research Fellow at the University of Leicester and author and expert on the UVF. Good morning, Aaron.
Oh, good morning, Stephen.
If the numbers that are being reported, 1,500 people, white shirts, black ties, black trousers, show of strength by the UVF is how it's being described. What is a large group of people like that in peacetime? What are they a membership of? What are some of them? They're all not members of the UVF, but what are some of them doing who are members of the UVF current day?
Yes, I mean, quite. 30 years on from the ceasefires, as Alison has rightly said, we still see groups coming together in a very disciplined way, all dressed exactly the same way. Actually, if you pay attention to the ties that they're wearing, they will tell quite an interesting story. But nevertheless,
why?
Coming together,
why?
Well, because some of them have got logos on them. And if you look very close, you'll see what those logos are. Now, I couldn't
make out
some of the images. Well, I mean, they're an affiliation to, in certain circumstances, to areas, they'll give the names of areas, and there'll be a badge there. So I'm not going to go into that because I haven't been able to see them up close, but I've seen them enough times, at Gable Ends wearing attire like this. What I haven't seen is actually them lining streets in quite those numbers that you've mentioned. 1,500 is a big number to put on the street. And, I think that there's no other way to look at this, and it is a message being sent. The message has been very clear since November that the East Belfast leadership as was has been stood down and replaced by a new leadership backed by the Shankill. And as Alison has pointed out, these people who were in the so-called old leadership have not gone away. They haven't left the stage. They've just ignored what's going on around them. And I think that the reality,
Aaron. Or given in, as in they acknowledge they're beat, they're out.
Well, in November, what happened was the UVF central leadership and the Shankill stood them down as a leadership team, but they didn't expel them. So this is not like in the 1990s with Billy Wright and his Mid-Ulster so-called brigade. They were expelled. 20 years ago in North Belfast and East Antrim, the UVF stood down a leadership and replaced it with another, and those people were quietly drinking in social clubs and accepting the new leadership, which turned out to be Gary Haggerty's leadership, who turned out to be a state agent. So the UVF have form in dealing with this sort of thing. But the reality is, this is what conflict transformation looks like in Northern Ireland in 2024.
What are these people doing who haven't transitioned yet all this time later? How many out of that 1,500 would be active members? What are they doing?
Well, they're meeting for commemorative events, clearly, they are affiliated in some way to various other cultural organisations like bands and this 36 Ulster Division you know, memorial commemorative organization. Well, some of them, absolutely. Those who are in the UVF now, whether they were there or not the other day, I can't be certain, but some of them are involved in criminality. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And those people in the East Belfast UVF who had been allied to the old leadership are almost certainly up to their necks because the Paramilitary Crime Task Force is raiding them every week. And as the Justice Minister has said, you know, this is deeply disturbing.
So, 1,500 men, many of them will have jobs. Many of them will have families and children. Where is the leverage? Where's the authority that tells those people, you will dress like this, you will be here at this time, you will stand there, you will do the following? Where's that leverage coming from? Who has all that power?
Well, there is an organisational structure there of some kind, whether it's non-military orientated or not. I think the message is clear in working class estates where deprivation is running rampant and where some people don't feel that they have any other choice than they signed up. They were recruited into those organisations and they'll do as they're told. The coercive edge that these organisations can really instill in people is something you know, that is alive and well in some of those deprived communities.
Well, to be coerced, there's a consequence if you don't. So what happens, whoever gave the order, what would happen to those people who said, no, I'm not doing it, stuff you?
Well, if they're, certainly if they, well, they're subject, if they are indeed members of the UVF, which is, as Alison says, difficult to prove. But if they are, there are rules and regulations, and like the IRA had its green book, they have their own rules and regulations. And they submit themselves to any kind of sanction or punishment that's dealt out. Now, either they can pay a levy to get out of trouble, or they can be beaten and accept a paramilitary assault, which is not what any civilized society wants to see. But that's the reality in those areas where these groups are strong.
Aaron, is the UVF, the present day UVF, simply a cover for pure drug dealing, other types of criminality, or is it an organisation genuinely trying to transition away from violence?
Well, that's difficult to pin down to an either or answer, really. As Alison has pointed out, you know, there are good reasons why you know, we shouldn't really take them at their word because of this so-called late transition period that they're supposed to be in, meaning that they're going to disband. But there's no sign of that whatsoever. And in fact, their structures remain in place. Now, they were committed wholeheartedly to the peace process, and then the Northern Ireland Protocol turned them away, turned their backs on the peace process, they would say, which is a very volatile and dangerous situation to be in. But nevertheless, a lot of the statements that we see associated with the Action for Community Transformation, whether it's the West Belfast organised one or the one in East Belfast, I mean, even they're split, they would say, they would use, in a very mealy-mouthed way, I must add, they would insist that they are leaving the stage, but that doesn't look like leaving the stage to me.
Let me bring in Peter McReynolds, the Alliance Party MLA. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. You sit on the policing board. What did you make of those scenes you saw at the weekend?
I think the way I would describe the scene, Stephen, is what was put to me by a friend that was coming to visit me on Saturday from North Belfast. He got stuck in the disruption. And whenever he got to my house, he said, what was happening there? It's all these men standing around wearing white shirts. It was really terrifying. I felt terrified. And I was aware of what had been going on. And I think it's just chilling what took place over the weekend. And certainly it's been acknowledged on the call already today that it's an acknowledgement of an ongoing feud. But it also sends a message to the lower community, or the community on the Lower Newton Arts Road, that there are groups at play still. And it's a reminder to the local community that they're still there, and they're basically coercively controlling the local community on the Lower Newton Arts Road.
I said, you sit in the policing board. Very difficult operation, this, for the police. What can they do?
I think it is, and I think there's an investigation going to be taking place now to establish if any offences were committed Certainly at the next meeting of the policing board, I'm going to be raising this, because I would have a fear that we're almost, which has been touched upon during the call already today, normalising the abnormal. This is a group that should not exist. This is a group that is a prescribed paramilitary organisation. And I think sometimes if you turn a blind eye, it's acknowledgement that that's OK, that's fine, but it's not OK. It's not acceptable in Northern Ireland in 2024. And it's something that I'm going to be raising with the Chief Constable at the next policing board meeting.
But it is OK with some of the power structures in Northern Ireland, Peter, because most journalists, most people that are that take a watchful eye over this type of stuff know exactly who the leaders are of all of these organisations. Those leaders are not put away. Those leaders are not taken by the authorities and criminalised. They remain powerful figures. They continue with the authority. They continue with the titles. They do so with impunity, do they not? They're household names.
Okay,
they're well known. They're known throughout the community.
And it's certainly not okay for me, and it's not okay for my colleagues in the Alliance Party, which is why yesterday I thought it was pertinent to raise the issue with Naomi as the Justice Minister, and important for us to condemn what has taken place over the weekend. I think Naomi's done incredible work as well with the Paramilitary Crime Task Force in terms of tackling these groups, and we need to let those groups break down these structures. But certainly across the political spectrum, we need to have overwhelming condemnation about these acts, and that's the way to really push them further away from the normal society.
There is a obstruction of the highway. There is law around that, but the reality is, Peter, there's no way the police can move in a situation like that, because then the greater good is not achieved. In other words, relative peace in that area. But you described it as intimidating. These people will continue to do this year after year after year.
Certainly, I don't think we're going to see police widely breaking up the so-called show of strength at the weekend. That was never going to take place. However, then for the police to come out and say that the parade passed off without any incidents, without any acknowledgement about the bizarreness of 1,500 people standing around in a sinister way, was quite strange, which is why I'm going to be raising with
but
the
is that statement
to find out what...
Is that, sorry to cut across you, is that statement in itself not indicative of where we're at in Northern Ireland society? People were intimidated. The police describe it as having passed off without incident. We know what they mean, but that's what it wasn't even an incident in their mind, was it? That there were 1,500 men showing a show of strength.
I think it shows the importance of language in sort of modern discourse in Northern Ireland. You know, sometimes these groups are referred to as paramilitaries, for example. We've used the term ourselves during this conversation. These are gangs. They're modern-day gangs that are harming communities, that are harming people and destroying lives. So it shows the importance of language, which is why I'm going to raise the issue with the Chief Constable at the next police forum meeting to find out what their investigation has shown already, and get an update in terms of what's happening within these organisations.
Peter, thank you. Aaron, before we go to the news this morning, how much money is swimming around these organisations? So this new leader, for example, that we're hearing you and Alison talk about, and indeed the ousted leader and all that goes with it, how much money is swimming around them if they become the leader of one of these gangster organisations?
Well, I think the former Chief Constable, George Hamilton, referred to the East Belfast element as a mid-range crime gang, but undoubtedly they're bringing in millions of pounds a year. Now, that element were bringing in millions of pounds thanks to the drug trade, and they're basically a shop front for international criminals, and they sell the drugs, and then the money's made by other people, but they skim off the top, they get their cut. Inside the wider organisation, of course, criminality is going on. They're leaning on people for protection money still in some areas. Okay, it's not widespread like it was back in the 1970s. But nevertheless, there is money coming in. Now, there's money coming in through their own membership who pay dues, but also it's coming in through funding bodies. Some of these groups that are connected, that claim to be charitable organisations, are affiliated to these old so-called paramilitary groups. Are being funded to carry out community-based projects to try and move them on into a conflict transformation era.
But what I want to go back to, just so that I get my head clear on this, is that the new leader, for example, in this show of strength, to show solidarity with the new leader, like, would that new leader be receiving personally hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands a year? What type of money is associated with being the leader?
Well, certainly it's a step up from a blue-collar job. The short answer is I don't know. But I guess that is lucrative or seen as lucrative. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. I mean, partly through loyalty and partly through commitment to their cause is one thing. But I think ultimately all of these people have to put food on the table and they do that any which way they can. And this is clearly through illegal means. As Peter has said, must be dealt with.
Okay. Dr. Aaron Edwards, thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Peter McReynolds this morning and indeed to Belfast Telegraph's Alison Morris. We'll pause there. Let's get the news. The Stephen Nolan Show! Gareth McCord has called the programme this morning. Morning, Gareth.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Your brother Raymond was murdered by the UVF. In that context, when you saw that show of strength at the weekend, what impact did it have on you?
It's, you know, Stephen, after all these years, I still find it very shocking, especially when the new chief constable coming in, he said he's going to make changes and this isn't going to happen no more. And it's just, you know, here in the news there, 30 years ago, Loughnane Island, killings, innocent people murdered in the pub watching a football, 30 years ago, and yet at the weekend we see 1,500 UVF men walking up and down broad daylight.
Well, they wouldn't all be in the UVF now. We don't know.
Okay. Well, we'll call it a UVF march because that there's what it was. They're being led by the PSNI, and you have Loughnane Island victims and all the victims since. And I don't want to just focus on victims because it's society as a whole that is suffering. East Belfast is suffering because the vast majority of East Belfast are good, honest people and don't want these people about. But because of people legitimising them and normalising it, they're free and able to walk up and down the street. And let's be honest, Stephen. Let's be honest here. The amount of people who are connected, and you have said this yourself, you have an individual who you regularly have on your show who you said is linked to the UVF. This is why these people are doing these things. It's not a normal society to have people.
I said they were formally linked to the UVF, but that's not the discussion
morning. No, totally. But, I mean, we have to focus on why these individuals and why these groups won't go away. And because they're given platforms on radio shows, on TV shows, and able to walk up and down the street, we've just had to suffer the legacy pill. And victims in society had to swallow that pill. There's not going to be justice. And you touched on an important point there.
You talk about the Chief Constable and the police. What can John Boucher do? Like, what on earth? Like, we talk about the reality of the situation on the ground in Northern Ireland. What could the police do in a situation like that on Saturday?
Well, the reality is, Stephen, and I think Aaron was touched upon it, people now are saying that these people are criminal gangs. Stephen, there always were criminal gangs. From when I was a young boy, these people sold drugs, they extorted businesses, they intimidated and they're still operating in the same way. There's no way on earth they're going to give this up because of money. So John Boucher, who I know is a very good man and will take up the challenge, but these people will not give up that lifestyle and go out and get a job like any normal person will. They will not let go of the community because still to this day they're recruiting young lads and getting them to do their dirty work because they're making an absolute fortune and they will never give that up.
Hey, can I state the obvious here? We've been talking about this since yesterday and then it was on the news cycles and all that comes with it. And the talk of a new leader. Does that leader, do you think that leader is in any way worried about getting scooped by the police? Do you think that leader is in any way fearful? You know, the most of us go out during the day and, you know, we go to park our car and we're worried about a traffic warden scooping us. If we go over the speed limit and we shouldn't, there's speed vans around every corner, for goodness sake. Do you think there is worry on that leader's mind that they're going to get done?
No, and that's an interesting point, Stephen, because what you've highlighted there is these young lads getting recruited, and they have no fear of getting jailed because the history has shown that the UVF and other paramilitaries are protected. As Alison pointed out earlier on, there was an individual on the walk who is in serious charges, gun charges, in court at the minute. So, you know, whenever society and young lads are seeing these people allowed to get away with anything because they're protected, let's do
leaders. Well, that individual we shouldn't speak about. Let's talk on a wider basis because they deny the charges.
Yes, totally. But that individual you're saying about the new leader, you know, they know that the police have protected them in the past. It's widely known. Alison and all the reporters have done it for years, and they have no fear of it, absolutely no fear. And that's just the sad reality. But I want to make a really important point, Stephen, to everybody listening today, especially these people who are in UVF and UDA and other organisations. They cannot leave. They want to leave. I know numerous people within UVF and UDA who want to leave because now they've got families, young kids, and they realise what's important in life, but they're not allowed to leave because their leadership is making so much money off them. And if they want to leave, they have to pay an extortionate amount of money to leave, but they're not allowed to leave. And there's so many, and I urge them to go to the police, do whatever they can for their young families. They cannot leave, because, and if they do leave, they have to pay a serious amount of money, and they still can't. And that's a sad reality of it. Once want to move on, and they can't.
I didn't know that. I really didn't. And look, if I'm naive, I'm naive. So what happens to, say, a young fella who has joined up and, you know, a year or two later thinks, this isn't for me, I don't want this? What happens to them?
Yeah. Well, the reality is, Stephen, this is the thing about people who live in the streets. It's very, very easy to get caught up in these gangs because of the amount of money. And young lads want to get money in their pocket, and that's fair enough. But whenever they realise, they get shocked because of some of the things they're asked to do. And then they get a wake-up call and go, oh, I want to get out of here. This is actually dangerous to my life. And when they go to ask to get out, they have to pay £10,000. Sometimes that £10,000 paid, and then they keep coming back for more. They went to their relatives, their fathers, their mothers, and even the grandmother's house, asking for money. And that's the reality. And anybody who's been involved in this so-called transition, restorative justice, they all know this. They all know that people who want out can't get
out. Where's the 10 grand go? Who gets it?
Well, exactly. You look at all them people that are on the road yesterday or the other day, and I know you're not going to say all of them are members, but to say a number of them were, they're paying dues along with the rest of them, monthly dues to the organisation. Where does that money go? Where does the money go from the drugs and the criminal and the extortion?
Well, what about the unexplained wealth orders that we have in Northern Ireland, where the police can, and look, they do use them? But what, all of this money going to these so-called leaders, does the money stay with them, or do we take it off them again?
Well, Stephen, that question opens up the wider view of the paramilitary task force. They're doing a very good job, and you hear it daily of the people who they're arresting and they're getting with drugs. Excuse me. But the one thing that they never get is leadership. They never get anybody at the top of the tree. They're getting the young lads, they're getting the ones who are doing the dirty work, but they never get the ones who actually have the money. And that there is a question I would put to the paramilitary task force. How are they affecting this here? These young lads won't make a difference scooping them up because they're replaced immediately. But the leadership, nobody's touching them. And that's a question, is why? Is the leadership being protected? Why is non-lemons being arrested? Because
we all know that the surveillance...
Oh, 100%, Stephen. Absolutely. You cannot have surveillance and the sophistication of the British intelligence services. And we can scoop up young lads, but we can't get the old men who've got the money. There's no doubt whatsoever. They were protected when it comes to murders, and they're protected when it comes to the finance.
When I introduced you this morning, I reminded people that your father was murdered by the UVF.
My brother?
Your brother, sorry. Your brother. Mm-hmm. Sorry, my fault. Your brother.
You're okay.
And sometimes that becomes a line of script. And for you, yeah, it's much more than that. So for these, yeah, people who are still supporting the UVF, can you remind everybody what they did to your brother?
Raymond got mixed up with the UVF. He thought the UVF could protect him from our family from UDA. But quickly, Raymond realized that these people are just as bad as UDA and used him. And unfortunately, Raymond was silenced because of things that he knew. Now, that's obviously devastated our family for many years, physical health and mental health. So I can see why young people get involved, but I can also see how it affects families. And I mean, that's 26 and a half years since Raymond was killed.
How did they kill him? Did they shoot him?
No, they beat him to death. They took away the gun, jammed, and then they beat him to death. It was a closed coffin. And yes.
So for those people that are, for those people who are being part of a show of strength, that's part of what they are endorsing. That's part of what they are supporting. So when they're lying in bed at night and thinking that they're, they're closing their eyes, going to sleep, thinking they've got some sense of morality, that's the type of organisation they're aligning themselves to.
Yes, Stephen, and you know, with Raymond's case, obviously that was the first case in British history to prove collusion with the Nuala Loans investigation. But, you know, at this day and age, I think everybody, and it's been on your show and other shows a number of times, the realities of the troubles, the truths of what actually happened, the Scapatichis and everything else. And I don't think anybody has a moral high ground on any side. We all lost and nobody won.
Do you expect more from the new Chief Constable? Do you expect more from him than others?
I do.
What do you expect from John Boucher?
I expect John Boucher to do his job. I suspected for many years after meeting other Chief Constables that they didn't have the final say. They wanted to do the job like the ordinary policeman, but they weren't allowed because there was this saying, it was always told for me from as a young lad, there was a bigger picture. But, I mean, transitioning after all these years, we're saying about the 30 years after Loughlin Island, and yet still are walking the streets. And I just want John Boucher and society, and again, I don't want to just make this about victims. Society as a whole wants John Boucher and his team to not make it normal for these people to walk about, to get rid of them. They actually do something about it. The flags flying and intimidating people. You know, victims have to walk about. My mother has to walk about with flags near where she lives, near where Raymond's buried. That is wrong. That is wrong in this day and age, after all this time, that people should get reminded and intimidated whenever they go to visit their son's grave.
Guys, thank you for coming on this morning. Thank you very much indeed. Good morning to you. 03030 80 55 55. Brian, morning, Brian.
Morning, Stephen. John Mann spoke very well there. What I'm on about is the more unionists, I'm talking about unionist representatives, come out and condemn this. What I was amazed at last night when I watched the news, excuse me, Merton Gibson saying that he was there, not one word of condemn. I condemn
from
that.
Whom?
Merton Gibson. He was on the news last night and said, well, he'd been interviewed.
We didn't hear the whole interview, did we? And I'm sure Mervyn Gibson, we didn't hear the whole interview, and we need to be careful.
What he did say, what amazed me, what he said.
You can't tell me what he said. You cannot tell me what he said because we haven't heard the whole interview. So let me.
But what I'm saying, Stephen, the more the politicians come on your program, and I notice they're not cheering up to come on your program today, is because of the election. Obviously, but they should be on condemning what happened on the Norwich Road.
Well, we've contacted all the political parties, all the main parties,
point,
giving them an invite to come on. And Mervyn Gibson would also talk about how he was very, very glad that there was no violence, and that he certainly would be someone who would be striving in this complicated society that we've got in Northern Ireland to do all that he can to bring peace to the streets. Look, we'll leave it there. 10 to 10, 03030 80 55 55. Let's move on. Last Friday, we heard representatives of the hospitality sector in Northern Ireland tell this programme that many restaurants are struggling to keep afloat. They claim profit margins are getting squeezed in the face of rising overheads and the cost of living crisis. Eamon McCusker, managing director of a number of Belfast restaurants, including AMPM, Chubby Cherub, said it's time tipping became part of the culture in Northern Ireland.
Well, here it's, I mean, the average is 10%, and I mean, the staff deserve it. You know, it gets transferred straight to the staff. But again, I personally believe that it needs to become part of the culture.
So should it become part of the culture more? You go to the likes of America, you don't tip at least 20%. In America, you get stared at as if something's wrong with you. In fact, they'll bite back at you and they'll ask you for more. Restaurant owner Sean McLaughlin with us today. Does this need to become more of the culture where you just don't walk out of a restaurant or anything in the entertainment sector without handing over a tip, Sean?
Stephen, good morning. Should it become a culture? It's hard to say. Look, service and remuneration come hand in hand, and if we give people good service and we look after them in the hospitality sector, as we are very well known in the world for in Northern Ireland, then they should be rewarded. You know, it's sadly a case of the chicken or the egg, and I think it becomes more apparent as the cost of living crisis and all these things come up, and that tips are an enhancement to people's lives and it helps them out, but only, in my opinion, if they deserve it. You know, I worked in the States. I lived there for a period of time. I know exactly what you're saying, and I know that there's people out there that just don't.
It's 20%. Sometimes 25%.
Well,
they're looking.
Well, back in my day, end of 15, and you know, I worked with guys who just didn't want to do the job because they knew they were going to get 15% off the bat anyway. But that being said, America's a very different case in terms of the wages that they get. Like, I would have got $30 for a full night shift in a bar from the owner, the equivalent of about $3 an hour, maybe. But you know, I walked out with maybe $400 or $500 at the end of it all because of the tips that I was receiving. So it's a very different setup, and you can't really compare America with Northern Ireland in that sense. In that they
for those people who setup. Can afford to pay, Sean, obviously it's different for those who cannot. For those people who can afford to pay, is it being mean, not handing over a tip?
I don't think it's being mean. I think if the tip is deserved and it's rewarded, then great. You know, if the service doesn't commensurate with that, then no. You know, there are people, and I've caught people out in my company before who say they're going to put the complete tip on a credit card, take cash off everybody and pocket it, and I've called them out for it, you know. So that's being mean. That's being deceitful, and that happens in our industry lots. But, you know, I think that, yes, look, I think people need to recognise the hard work that we do behind scenes, that we do in front of service times as well, and start to understand that, you know, hospitality now is a profession. It's a chosen profession for lots of people. Years ago in Northern Ireland, it was a stopgap for students. Now people are choosing to go into the industry because they can make a career out of it. And I certainly did. And Stephen, by the way, I served you many a day in a hotel just across from Broadcasting House there. And in fairness, you know, you always looked after us fairly well because we looked after you. So, you know, it's all part of it.
What's a good tip?
That's
what do people normally give who do tip?
Well, look, you know, I think in general most people would be on a 10 to 15% mark in their head. You know, some places impose service charges. That's a conversation for another day. But, you know, I think that, you know, a tip in and around 10 to 15% based on our wages here in Northern Ireland and the cost of produce and things and the cost of a meal would be a fairly fair way to look at it, providing that the service is right.
03030805555. Phil Kelly with us today. Morning, Phil.
Good morning, Stephen.
You're against tipping, are you? Why?
Well, my main tip to anybody in the hospitality industry is to get unionised, join a trade union, and make sure you fight for decent wages, decent terms and conditions. Listen, no one should rely on a voluntary gratuity to top up their wages.
Yes, but for those people get in, Phil, buying a fancy meal or buying any type of meal, should they as standard be given a tip to some of the lowest paid workers in our community?
Well, there's the issue. Why are they the lowest paid workers in our community? Base pay must always be sufficient, and we must normalise the idea to use.
But
the
that's
word
not
you're
the discussion we're. That's not the discussion we're having this morning. But the discussion we're having this morning, whether people should be on whatever level of wages, is a valid discussion, but a different discussion. The discussion this morning, Phil, is about tipping and whether people should be morally obliged to tip.
No, I'm sorry, you're wrong. The owners of these companies, the managers of these companies, should be morally obliged to pay their workers a living wage and not leave it to the whim of customers to top up those low wages, because this is an industry which is characterized by staff shortages and low wages. And you know, the idea of topping up low wages by a gratuity is completely disgusting. These workers need fair pay and conditions, and that.
But for those customers coming in, being served by those workers, for those who can afford, should they be tipping 10 or 15%?
Well, I don't care what some wealthy customer wants to put on the table for good service, but what I'm saying is it's more important that the people in that sector enjoy proper terms and conditions and decent wages. And you can, there's many books written on the history of tipping and where it comes from, and workers should never have to rely on that. They need proper, fair pay, a living wage.
Sean?
Absolute poppycock, Stephen. Our industry looks after our team. We are engaged in looking after our teams and our people. We don't govern what the wages are, and it's not a voluntary top-up to their wages. It's a reward for good service. It's a piece to turn around and say, listen, we thank you for what you've done. We appreciate that. That's what a tip is. It's not to do with topping up, and it's certainly not something that I use to top up any of my staff. Majority of my team are all paid over and above the minimum wage. They all get made sure they're looked after in terms of their holidays. They all make sure that they've got breaks when they need it. We even close over Christmas to make sure they get time with their family. So sorry, Phil, you're just generalising a whole industry there, and you're wrong.
Just to put that into perspective, one of the things we've talked about when we talk about culture is America leads the way in the tipping culture. Well, that has done nothing to address the fact that hospitality workers remain in the United States some of the lowest paid, lowest sector workers. And if you even go back to Federal Delaney Roosevelt, the president of the United States, when he introduced a minimum wage, restaurant workers were excluded from that because of the tipping culture in the US. We need to get away from this idea, and we need to get down to the real reality, which is pay workers what they're worth, give them a decent wage and decent terms and conditions.
And Martin's in Bangor. Hold on, let me bring Martin in. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Stephen.
Morning, well, go ahead.
I'd ask a question. What is a tip? A tip is something extra. A tip is something on top. A tip is something you get someone as a by way of appreciating something they've done for you above and beyond what you would normally expect.
Well, so is it, though? Occurs, because, you go into the barbers, right? And they say 18 quid for a haircut. And you hand them a 20 quid note. Are you standing waiting for the 2 quid back?
Yes. Unless I say, keep the change because I felt I got extra or something above and beyond what I would have expected.
What if you don't get extra? But this is what I'm trying to do with this discussion this morning. What if you don't get extra? Is it just the done thing now, or should it be the done thing to give some of these workers who are standing on their feet all day a couple of quid extra?
Nobody, for example, tips my wife for doing her job in the community, standing on her feet all day, serving people all day. She doesn't get tips. So how do we define who gets tips? Why is it just hospitality and service sector people? Why don't we tip everybody?
All right, Martin, thank you.
Tipping should be a reward.
Thank you very much. 030-3080-5555. Is the number to call this morning. Do you tip? How much do you tip for those people that don't tip? Are they being mean? 030-3080-5555. The news comes next. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Thanks for joining us on the Nolan Show today. It's 30 years since 6 men were shot dead and 5 were wounded during an attack by the UVF in Lochan Island.
The latest sectarian atrocity in Northern Ireland has brought widespread condemnation. Six Catholic men were murdered as they watched last night's World Cup football in a village pub in County Down. The Northern Ireland Secretary, Sir Patrick Mayhew, called it an act of moral squalor that could achieve no political purpose. The Irish Prime Minister, Albert Reynolds, said it was barbaric and incomprehensible. Five other people were wounded when two loyalist gunmen walked into the bar in Lochinn Island and opened fire with automatic assault rifles.
The attack was on the crowded Heights Bar. People had been watching the Republic of Ireland playing in the 1994 World Cup. All those who died were Catholic civilians. It was one of the worst atrocities of the Troubles. With me now, Baroness Margaret Ritchie, whose family ties to two of the men and has vivid memories of that night. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Stephen.
Long time since I've spoken to you, Margaret. Long time. Yes, so good to hear from you again.
And this is a very poignant day for all of us as we remember the men who died.
What are your memories of that night?
Well, I remember it very well because I was visiting my late aunt, who was a sister-in-law of Barney Green's. And I remember leaving her around about 10 o'clock. And maybe it was later, maybe about 10:30. And when I came down our main Annacloy Road, I noticed a lot of, police cordons around the entrance to the Lochinn Island Road. And when I arrived home, I went on to bed and I was promptly alerted by phone calls on a constant basis that there was a problem in Lochinn Island. And my then former boss, Eddie McGrady, then MP for South Down, had contacted me and he was on his way to Lochinn Island. He told me that six men had been killed. So I always knew that my cousin's uncle and their cousin went on an alternative basis to O'Toole's Bar on a Saturday night. So I rang them and I was told that Barney Green and Dan McCrinner had been shot dead. Shall I say, I was utterly perplexed and flabbergasted and full of disgust, but also full of sorrow and sadness. And I always remember that. I don't think anybody in anybody's house locally slept on that particular night. Our lives, but the lives of those victims and their families were totally shattered in an unforgivable act of, mortal destruction.
Two gunmen walked in and took out AK-47s from under
their
coats.
And they took out six good men in a community who were contributing to that community and contributing to the local communities all around Lochinn Island. People who offered their services to the community, who looked after the marginalised and the underprivileged. That is the sort of people they took out. People of sound standing in our local community. Something that was condemned right across the world, but right across our community, and I mean cross-community-wise.
What was the reaction in the days that followed?
Well, the reaction was one of revulsion, one of disgust. Well, I suppose there was anger there as well, but there was also that sense of sorrow, sadness, emotional sentiment, but also that there must be ceasefires and we must get away from this wanton act of, bodily destruction and also destruction of property, but destruction of lives. And remember, 1994 was also poignant because it was the year of the IRA ceasefire and then the Loyalist ceasefire. And I always remember watching the programme, I think it was on UTV, about the Loyalist ceasefire in October of that year, where it said there'll be many a chair that lie vacant tonight. And I thought immediately of those six families in Lochinn Island because it was very close to us in terms of geography, but also in terms of family victims. I knew Barney and Dan very, very well since I was a child.
And of course, searching for the truth and the truth around the collusion that there was a significant feature of those murders.
Absolutely. And we had initially Baroness O'Loan's ombudsman's report, and then she left office, but her report, as I understand it, was going to be very strong. Then we had Al Hutchinson's report, which I always remember was a bit of a sham, and it was his officers then disassociated themselves from that report, and at that time I asked him to resign. Then we had the report from Michael Maguire, the very fulsome report that showed, revealed the truth to the families and did give them a period of good reflection and also a period of relief. But there is one outstanding thing, Stephen, the issue of justice and accountability. And I heard Niall Murphy, their solicitor, this morning, and he is right. That is the one thing that has abated us. And that's what not only did the Ombudsman's report reveal the need for, but also the two films, No Stone Unturned, the need for justice and accountability. Because at the end of the day, and I remember having an adjournment debate on this issue in September, either 2015 or 2016, the dogs in the street know what happened and they know who was involved. So I would urge the new chief constable to expedite efforts to go and find those people and bring them to justice, because justice is urgently required.
Margaret, finally, I said that you and I hadn't spoken for quite a long time. Where do you think Northern Ireland's at the moment in terms of all of that hatred and venom that led to people killing and maiming people? We're talking about paramilitaries at the top of the show this morning.
Yes, and I heard that and I was saddened to hear about that. But then that, to me, is simply a reflection, perhaps, maybe of still division within our society and a level of sectarianism. There is no doubt we have to move on from all of that. And I do think we have become a more inclusive, respectful society. And that is the way that progressive communities demand. And that is the way of progressive politics. We have to move on with inclusion, with respect for political difference, with parity of esteem. Those fine words that my former leader, John Hume, talked about and what the Good Friday Agreement was about, building relationships and reconciliation and healing. And we have to get to that point.
Margaret, thanks very much. Nice to talk to you this morning. Thank you. 11 minutes past 10. Parents of children with special educational needs were at Stormont yesterday to share their concerns of what's been described as a special needs crisis surrounding school places. According to the Education Minister, Paul Given, there are around 400 children still waiting for a decision on a school place for September. Emma Morgan is from the parents-led advocacy group Send Reform NI. Good morning, Emma. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Stephen. Can you hear me okay?
I certainly can. My goodness, that figure, 400 children still waiting for a decision.
Yes, and I think it's only the tip of the iceberg, really, with regards to the problems that there are for the SEN education system in Northern Ireland. We heard from so many parents yesterday whose children are in P3, P4, P5, and they're having to be kept at home because they're in inadequate placements currently. So the figures of 400 are the children who are only starting into our education system, but the problems are so widespread, even going into children leaving school as well. So it's a big issue, but yesterday was a very positive day. We had so many different stakeholders involved in the education system there, and everybody seemed to be singing off the same hymn sheet that there are so many problems with regards to the education system with our children that require more help. But it was hopeful, and from this time last year we were standing protesting outside Stormont, but yesterday we were inside having hopefully meaningful discussions around key topics. However, hope really isn't enough at this stage for parents, because there were so many parents there who were completely frustrated around the inadequate placements their children are in. There had despair around the lack of communication with regards to transitions for September, and so many mothers in particular that were having their jobs impacted.
Caroline Deveney is also with us this morning. Morning, Caroline.
Hi, Stephen. Hi.
I know, Caroline, you've been in touch with us here at the Nolan Show about your son, Harry, who didn't have a school place. You got in touch with us, and one's been offered last night after we got in touch with the Education Authority. Is that right?
Correct, Stephen, yes. It was late yesterday afternoon. We received word that he had got an offer of a satellite school in Balnahinch. Now, we live in South Belfast, very close to a cluster of special schools. And why they're sending him to Balnahinch, I do not know.
Where were you at? Where were you at up until you'd contacted us? And then we'll look at what's happened next. What were they saying to you?
I had got informed 2 weeks ago by the principal of our first choice that an offer would be made for Harry. And we were totally ecstatic. You know, we were delighted.
That was Harberton, right?
It was Harberton, yes. And I have it in writing, you know, 2 weeks ago. And I picked up the phone to the EA on Friday to chase it. And I was told, sorry, your son hasn't got a place there. There was no reason given. You know, I pushed for answers. What was the criteria? How many spaces? They can't tell me anything. We're completely in the dark. I've had to resort to going to
yourself.
But you're
saying the principal had told you that
Correct.
A place was available?
Correct. In writing 2 weeks ago. And we were delighted. You know, we thought that was it. We were sorted. And we found out late on Friday, only because I picked up the phone to the EA, that he hadn't been awarded that place. And this school,
so this was a letter to you. You don't have it in front of you, do you?
I have an email to say that they returned the consultation to the EA on the 28th of May and Harry would be offered a place at Harberton.
That's in black and white.
It is. It is.
And there's been no explanation why they withdrew that place?
None. And I have pushed Stephen.
How is that good enough? How is that respectful? What does it do to a child? You tell a child, here's the name of your new school, here's where you're going. You're doing that because they've put it in writing to you. And then these people think that they can treat you with silence as to why that's been withdrawn. The Education Authority think they can do that, do they?
Well, yes, they do. And as I say, it was only because I picked up the phone to them that I found this news out. You know, we had started showing Harry pictures on Facebook of Harberton, you know, getting excited about his uniform. We were just so relieved. And to have that taken away from us, it's just been devastating. And this school is on our doorstep, Stephen. I could walk to it if I wanted to. But yet he's been offered a school in Balnahinch. He wouldn't cope. He'd be 2 hours on a bus or a taxi. He has seizures. He has ADHD. He doesn't cope well in the car. Never mind on a bus or a taxi for 2 hours a day. You know, my son can't communicate what he's thinking or what he's feeling. If he was to have a seizure come over him, he wouldn't be able to alert anybody on that bus or taxi. You know, it's just not practical for him.
And have any of these authorities been prepared to sit down and talk this through with you?
Only as of this morning when they knew I was going on the Nolan Show. So it shows you the tactics that us parents have to resort to in times of crisis to speak to people and to get things moving.
I would say this to the Education Authority this morning. I would ask this question. Who do you think you are providing silence to these parents? Not giving an explanation. A parent who has sat down and discussed with their children, the school that they were told in writing that child was going to. Who do you think you are? Stonewalling parents with reasonable questions. You are there to provide a public service. What is in your heads when you don't answer basic questions? Like, what has happened to this place for my child? Like, there may be perfectly reasonable answers that Caroline will not like. Because you're under pressure, there aren't enough school places, everybody gets it. But you think you can get away with just being silent to parents, do you? Is that the type of organisation you are? And Caroline telling us this morning the only reason you've now decided to communicate with her is because she's on the BBC. Is that the type of organisation you are? Caroline, are you sure they behaved like that?
Absolutely. I have it in black and white. I have a paper trail. I have actually told them, don't phone me. I want everything in black and white because the trust has just been completely broken now. You know, and we're just in the dark and we just don't know what's going to happen now come September.
But did you actually get through to someone and ask them questions?
Only whenever I have to say I will escalate this and go to the media and MLAs did they move on sending my child's paperwork to the schools. Other children's have been sent ahead of my child's. I don't know why they were supposed to all do it at the same time. And only when I made threats of media and MLAs did anything move for me. The EA pledged this year that they will have a blanket approach to all these consultations. That did not happen. I know for a fact from principals, some consultations were received ahead of others. And those link officers trying to do the right thing, trying to hold the party line, trying to abide by the dates, we got penalised. Those families got penalised.
But when you've asked them what has happened to this place at Harberton, what have they said?
Nothing. They haven't responded to the question.
Did you put the question in writing or verbally or what happened?
I put it in many emails, so it's in writing.
Over a period of days or weeks or what?
From Friday, from I found out on Friday.
So now you've had to tell your child what?
The devastating news that he hasn't got a school that's a 2 mile drive from our house or a 2 mile walk from our house, and he may have to go to Ballinahinch, which just isn't suitable. You know, we have these big name schools on our doorstep. I do not know why we are not getting placed there. Who is getting in before my child? Like, and why? Just tell us the reasons. Be transparent.
And look, I want to speak to the Older Persons Commissioner in the next few seconds. The Children's Persons Commissioner, sorry, in the next few seconds. But how was it communicated with you that the placement at Harberton had been withdrawn?
Because on Friday, I picked up the phone to the EA to chase up the notification from them. And I was told by Michelle McColgan from the EA, sorry, your son does not have a place there. And I was shocked.
And did you say why?
No, they didn't.
Let's talk to the Commissioner for Children and Young People, Chris Quinn. Good morning, Chris.
Morning. How are you?
Is this how parents are going to be treated now? And can you do anything about it?
So, I am in post now almost 9 months, Stephen, and this is the issue that hits my inbox most frequently. We have a crisis, in my opinion, we have a crisis with special educational needs. And my call on the executive is to treat it as such. So my role as commissioner is to keep under review the adequacy and effectiveness of services that are provided to children and young people. And I'm of the view that what we're seeing now is a breach of children's rights. So I have spoke with a plethora of parents. I have visited schools. I have hosted roundtables. And I'm asking the executive to prioritise this. Now, I'm glad that the Minister for Education has set out this as a priority for him, but I'm asking that his executive colleagues support him and that they work together to address this crisis.
Well, you're describing it as a crisis. Mm-hmm. There is the lack of places for these children, mm-hmm. but there is also common decency and understanding of the impact it must have on a child when they're told the name of the school they're going to. These are children with special needs.
Yeah.
They've extra challenges. And so mom and dad sits down, says, here's your new school, let me tell you about it. And then that school is ripped away from these children without any explanation.
Yeah, well, look, let's think about Harry and Caroline. And Caroline, thanks for sharing your story on the airwaves. No one can imagine how difficult the situation is for you and your child right now. A big concern for me as Commissioner for Children and Young People is that question of who is supporting our parents, who is supporting these children. My office and I would advocate for early intervention and support so that that support and communication with parents and children is happening at the earliest possible stage.
Will your office inquire, and we will also, but will your office inquire if this is a one-off or if there is a pattern of children being given, told they've been given places, and then the education authority saying it's not happening? Will you use Harry's case as a point to look into what is going on?
Well, with regards to Harry, I would urge that Caroline contact my office and we can look at this through our legal and investigations team. But generally speaking, rest assured that my colleagues and I in NICI are treating this as such. There are patterns. We are acutely aware of issues around communication and engagement, around resourcing, around early intervention, about the fact that we don't have the facilities. And what we're trying to do is hold government to account. We're working with the Education Authority. We're working with DE. But crucially, we are listening to parents and to children and to school leaders. And I'm trying to do whatever I can in my power to look towards September 2024 and beyond.
You mentioned, Chris, school leaders. Graeme Gault is National Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers in Northern Ireland. Morning, Graeme.
How are you, Stephen?
My goodness, the pressure on schools around this must be immense as well.
Well, it's incredible. What struck me at yesterday's event at Stormont, though, was that all of the responses to the research that SEN Reform have done could, all that the parents were telling them could also have been written by teachers and school leaders, because we are in this crisis that is impacting our children together, and collectively we're all throwing our arms up in despair. What is particularly shocking about the story that you've just brought this morning with your caller and her very difficult circumstance for her wee son there in South Belfast is some of those schools in that area that you're talking about have been seeking additional capacity through trying to get prefabricated buildings on their site to expand what they can do in that community for a very, very, very long time, and have been being knocked back again and again and again. So school leaders and schools have been
knocked
trying,
back by who?
By the system. I'm not sure whether that's the Education Authority or the department, but they have been appealing for expanding their capacity. And listen, special schools are buildings that have been purpose-built. The geography and the fabric of the building have been created and designed for children with additional and complex needs, which is a very different situation to the units that are being put up and established in mainstream schools across the system. And so parents do have a right to seek the most appropriate placement for their children, and the responsibility is upon the system to provide that. And for years, the special sector has been seeking additional capacity to meet the increasing need for such a long time. And it is really encouraging that the minister is putting money behind that for the future, but the crisis affecting these children and these parents that you're talking about is right now.
The Education Authority have sent us through a statement. They say ensuring all children with a statement of SEN receive the right support from the right people at the right time is critical priority for the Education Authority. They say while the EA recognises the rights of parents to express their preferences for school placement and indeed encourages them to do so, all final placement decisions are determined by the EA Statutory Assessment and Review Service. We fully understand, they say, this is an anxious time. Well, do you? Do you understand it's an anxious time if this parent on the radio this morning is telling us that you can't even tell her or explain to her why she's gotten black and white a school placement confirmed by the school principal and the EA have said it's not happening? You think it's reasonable to not explain to that parent why it's not happening, do you? Is that what you think is reasonable? Graham, what's the solution to this?
Money, Stephen. This is the direct result of years and years and years of underinvestment to the tune of not just millions, but hundreds of millions of pounds. The school leaders have been arguing about this for a decade, saying that this crisis was coming. Well, here it is, and it's a result of political choice. So our politicians need to make some political choices urgently here about direct money to this crisis.
Well, we do know that the Department of Education, that's through the Minister, Paul Given, they've made it clear that this is a priority for them. It is about money. The goal, they say, is about capacity and resources, support and opportunities. It'll require investment from the executive if we are to deliver, they say, the transformation required. Caroline, we're going to get on to the EA on your behalf this morning. The Commissioner for Young People, Chris Quinn, has said that his office will do the same. And let's just find an explanation, at least the facts for your son, Caroline, okay?
Yeah, thank you, Stephen.
It's a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Emma. Thank you, Graham. Thank you, Caroline. Thank you to the Commissioner for Young People, Chris Quinn. We'll see you all in the morning. Thanks for your company today. Bye-bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.